From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek. Our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson suffered a series of damaging defeats over the government's policy on leaving the European Union. A coalition of opposition and conservative lawmakers are attempting to pass legislation to prevent Britain from exiting the European Union with no deal on October 31st. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam withdrew an extradition bill that sparked 3 months of pro-democracy protests, a move that she said China understands, respects, and supports. The Trump administration is moving ahead with plans to divert $3.6 billion from military construction projects to build or fortify portions of a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, while Vice President Mike Pence arrived in Ireland this week, where he raised some eyebrows with his travel accommodations and his comments about Brexit. And Hurricane Dorian cut a path of destruction through the Bahamas, leaving the island nation desperate for international aid and intensifying concerns over the effects of climate change. Welcome, panelists, today. And let's start off with Brexit and Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson came into office with a couple of what he thought were very good chess moves, if you will, in terms of parliamentary procedure. And those have not advanced his cause and may have even caused him a setback. Nihal, I'll start with you. His first couple of weeks, not really good weeks for the new prime minister.
Yeah. In fact, the other day I Googled who is the shortest serving prime minister in Britain.
Not a good sign.
Just because I'm honestly curious how long Boris is going to last. Yeah, he has tried to basically suspend parliament. He's talked about getting a new election, a snap election, and everything is lining up against him. His own brother basically quit parliament, you know, the rare politician who wants to do it to spend less time with his family out of protest over what's happening. So it's kind of incredible and it's kind of fascinating, you know, for Britain to be going through this. There are a lot of countries in the world who were once under British colonial rule who are probably just watching this with some pleasure, perhaps.
Indeed. Jonathan, as you assess this situation and look at it, we thought Theresa May had it bad. It seems like Boris Johnson really has it worse.
Exactly. I mean, he had three strikes against him. He tried to, as you say, suspend Parliament. Parliament basically fought back and didn't allow him to do that. Then the Parliament passed a bill that would prevent Britain's exit from the EU with no deal. That bill is in motion now, actually.
Yeah.
The House of Lords has to approve it, but feeling is they will. And then he wanted a snap election, and they stopped that. Now, I think there will be an election, probably later this fall, November or so, and we'll see who wins. Things don't look good for him.
And when you look at the situation, when he's trying to negotiate a deal, if he's trying to get some sort of deal with the European Union, is there an ally? Is there anyone even to shake hands with on a deal? Is anyone at the European Union even willing to negotiate at this point? Or is it pretty much Boris Johnson talking to no one? There's no one to shake hands with.
The EU has repeatedly said that they've offered a deal and that's the best deal they're going to get. And that's it. I mean, this is what the past 2-3 years with Theresa May were all about. And she's probably one of those who's also watching thinking, haha, you thought you could do better than me. And, you know, Boris, he has an ego and he comes in thinking, oh, I'll just smooth talk people or whatever, the same way that he smooth talked a lot of people into voting for Brexit. And now he's finding out, oh, here's the reality, because in a negotiation, there's other people involved.
I guess the question is, does he really want to negotiate, or is a hard exit something that he's wanted from the beginning? He has U.S. President Donald Trump on his side saying that he will give him everything in terms of negotiation. So is it really kind of a political victory, although a pale one for him, just to have a hard Brexit?
Yeah, I mean, you do get the sense that he would be fine with a hard Brexit. I think a lot of Brexiteers actually like the idea of that. They feel like, let's just do it. Why should we go on any terms that have to do with the Europeans? But that just really opens Britain up to chaos. And not to mention the world economy. And also, Boris, yes, he has Trump telling him, oh, we'll support you no matter what. You're really smart. You'll get it done. But at the same time, Trump's aides have been very clear that they're not going to give British an easy time on a trade deal. I mean, there's already arguments over everything from about chlorinated chicken to other types of food standards. And I just think if he's honestly thinking that the U.S. is going to like be easy on him in a trade deal, like he's out of his mind. I mean, this president is one who has slapped tariffs on allies already. So there's no reason to think he's actually going to be kind to the British.
Very good point. As we look for paths forward, Jonathan, so there is the hard exit from the European Union. When we look for other alternatives, is there any sort of path, a constitutional path, to either rescinding or redoing this referendum or having some other path to staying in the European Union or extending it? What are the pathways to compromise here?
This is exactly the question that they've been struggling with for the past 3 years. Basically, British politics have descended into a situation of political mayhem. What Boris Johnson is saying is, I don't really want a no-deal Brexit, but neither does the EU, because this is the second largest economy in Europe, and if we pull out with no deal, they're going to get hurt too. So that's my leverage. My leverage is to go into these negotiations and saying, hey, I don't care.
So mutually assured destruction.
Yes, exactly. And we are willing to do that. So it's a game of chicken. And he's also been a bit disingenuous. He says that his negotiator, who's over in Brussels right now, has put forward proposals and things are moving along swimmingly. And in fact, the people over at the EU are saying, we haven't heard any proposals. And of course, Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour opposition, has pointed this out, also has pointed out exactly what Nahal was saying, that Britain will end up negotiating with the United States, which will put America first and Britain a distant second.
A distant second. I think that most would agree with that. Yeah. Your thoughts, Nahal, to close it out. Is there any other
pencil? I would just say that, you know, Boris, to some extent, operates in this ambiguity, right? And he likes that. I don't think he would mind at all if it all ends up being a hard Brexit. One thing I can tell you is, and I know this, like businesses in Britain and Europe, they're planning and have been for a long time for a hard Brexit. Like they just don't see a deal happening.
Yes, and it's hard to see a path forward. Again, we don't see the partners to compromise. You have to have someone to shake hands with in order to get a compromise. And even within his own government, he doesn't seem to have that.
Also, the date is October 31st. It's Halloween. I don't know who came up with that idea. I've been in London on Halloween night. It is terrifying. People staggering around. I can't imagine what it's going to be like with Brexit.
I think their takeaways are Halloween and a game of chlorinated chicken. There, takeaways from this particular segment. Well, let's move on to Hong Kong protests. Again, Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam has rescinded this extradition bill that sparked the democracy protest. It seems like a victory, but the protesters themselves are saying that it's too little too late. John, I'll start with you. The extradition bill, do you see it as a victory for the protesters?
I think it's a partial victory for them, but they feel that they have got Carrie Lam sort of on the run, and they are going to push forward with their other demands, which is a police investigation into the police handling of the demonstration.
The protests themselves have created issues on top of the issues
exactly
that were being protested originally.
Right. And the second one is they want more democracy. They want direct elections. They want to basically cut Beijing out of the process. Now, Beijing is very angry about this. They do not like this. So for now, the situation has calmed. The markets have come up again. The head of the American Chamber of Commerce says that Hong Kong is now a safe place to do business and invest. But there's more to come. So we're not done with this yet.
We'll talk a little bit more about long-term stability in a minute. I'll come back to you. Nahal, Carrie Lam made an extraordinary statement. I just want to read part of it. For a chief executive, she's talking about herself, for a chief executive to have caused this huge havoc to Hong Kong is unforgivable. It's just unforgivable. If I have a choice, the first thing is to quit. Having made a deep apology, is to step down. She made this statement into tape recorders, by the way, and then denied having said it. Beijing said that it was fake news. Obviously, it undermines the credibility of that particular chief executive. I guess my thought is, how important is Carrie Lam or any chief executive? How critical is that position to any negotiation that goes forward? Or is that person essentially just a mouthpiece for what's going on in Beijing?
That's a tough one. I mean, it seems like Carrie Lam very much underestimated the anger that this has caused. And it's not just a matter of like the fact that earlier she suspended the bill, which wasn't enough for the protesters, or now she's withdrawn it. It's that she allowed it to be introduced in the first place. I mean, the question there is like, why would you think that this is going to go over well with this population of yours that is used to democracy and human rights and those types of things and does not want to get under the thumb of Beijing. And so is this position important? I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that the protesters want direct elections is because they feel like this chief executive position is very much a tool or can be one of Beijing in the future.
Jonathan alluded to the fact of the markets rebounding and what Hong Kong has always had. I lived there for 5 years myself. What it's had is that feeling of its stability and constancy, you know, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And if you undermine that, you really have destroyed Hong Kong as a marketplace and sort of the core of it. There's something called Lion Rock Spirit, which refers to perseverance, solidarity, the possibility of improvement, and responsibility for maintaining that sense of advancement. It's very much almost American type of spirit there. If that sort of thing is broken, say by, and I'll throw this to either panelist who wants to comment, when you have things like Cathay Pacific being forced to fire employees who are agreeing with protests, when you have Cathay Pacific having pilots not being allowed to land in Beijing, land their planes, if the pilots have agreed with the protests, is this the economic version of rolling tanks through Tiananmen Square?
Yes, in a way it is. I mean, there isn't death the way there was at Tiananmen, where thousands were killed.
I don't want to underestimate the seriousness of Tiananmen by making that comparison.
Of course, please, sure. But, you know, one of the tactics that Xi Jinping has used is to mass security forces on the border at Shenzhen, which is just over the border on the mainland.
On the mainland, yeah.
Right. I was based in Beijing for 3 years back in the 80s, and to go to Hong Kong was like going to heaven. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the whole spirit of the place, it was much more capitalistic than America was. I mean, it was totally unfettered capitalism. And that is the culture in Hong Kong. To get back to a point Nahal made, which is that Carrie Lam should have known before introducing this bill the sort of reception it got. There were demonstrations several years ago, the umbrella protests.
Yes.
And the whole idea of Beijing trying to erode this agreement when they took possession in 1997, they were supposed to basically operate under one state, two systems for, I think, until 2027 or something like that, around then.
I believe that's right.
Yeah. And all the other Chinese leaders preceding Xi Jinping honored that. Xi Jinping is not.
It's not, yeah. It's a great difference between them. I'm going to let you get one more comment in after we take a break, and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Also, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. And visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek. Our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back. Nahal, do you want to make one last comment on Hong Kong?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, on the one hand, you could argue that Beijing has evolved in its approach to these things compared to Tiananmen Square. They seem to be approaching this knowing the world is watching, knowing that they have to be more careful, more sophisticated. On the other hand, this is in some ways, you know, if you're a China hawk, a preview of the future of the world as China gets more dominance and influence over many other countries. I mean, there's a strong possibility that, you know, even if there's not an official government relationship, that they could have this sort of influence on these other countries in a way that erodes the freedoms of the people there. And I think for a lot of China hawks, they're watching this and thinking, uh-oh, this is not a good sign.
I can only agree with you there and agree with you, Jonathan, that there's much to be done and much to be seen in the future on the rest of these reforms as they evolve over time. Let's move on to the Trump administration is moving ahead with plans to divert $3.6 billion from military construction projects to build or fortify portions of a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Power of the purse belongs to Congress. I believe that the Trump administration is doing this on the authority of emergency powers that were declared earlier in the year. Again, you have Republican senators, Republican lawmakers whose funds are being taken literally from their constituencies to do this thing. And my good Jonathan, as a policy move effective, as a political move effective?
I guess that really depends on which constituency you're trying to appeal to. Now, it's absolutely correct that normally the power of the purse rests in the hands of Congress. and Congress appropriates money. They authorize it and then they appropriate it and they give it to the various branches of the administration. Within the departments, they can decide where they want that money to go. They can shift it from one account to another. But for the president to basically defy a decision by Congress would require emergency powers. In that case, the president can do that. So then it becomes, as you say, a policy and a political question.
I mean, some of the senators, some of the elected officials who are losing money in this one, Senator Martha McSally, a Republican senator from Arizona, $30 million in funds are being diverted from an army base in her state. Other Republican senators include Tom Tillis of North Carolina, $80 million, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, our Senate Majority Leader, $62 million, John Cornyn of Texas, $48 million, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, $11 million. These are some of the president's most staunch supporters. Will there be any pushback from these people, do you think?
I think there might be some, sort of almost like a pro forma. I don't anticipate they'll do anything significant, although it's kind of a mixed bag, right? I mean, there is a lot of frustration in Congress with the executive branch's constant attempts to, like, reconfigure the way funding is supposed to be appropriated. Like, that has been a frustration, and there has been some fight back on a bipartisan basis. But, I mean, you know, you have an election year coming up. Are the Republicans really going to try to pillory the president with this when they're thinking about who's going to win in November, the next November? I mean, I don't see this as becoming something they're willing to go to the mat for.
And it's an interesting point to discuss because, as you say, it's next November. Each of the senators that I mentioned is up for reelection. So typically, a senator goes into a district or to a state and says, I managed to bring this much money to our state. And in this case, they have to defend this much money leaving the state. Kind of a delicate balance for anyone who's running for office.
It's a very delicate balance. But, you know, Trump ran on a campaign promising a border wall. Biggest promise, I think, that he made.
That Mexico was going to pay for.
Of course, right. But nevertheless, you know, it's like the people have forgotten that. I mean, I think, you know, we as journalists remember that, and of course Democrats remember that.
Certainly.
But I don't think his base really cares anymore. I think that they want the wall. And Trump says that there's a national emergency, which the base agrees with. And I think that these senators who are up for re-election and who are in this difficult spot, it'd probably be politically prudent for them not to pillory the president and to make the argument for the wall on the basis of the campaign promise.
I'm going to shift a little bit to Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence's visit, his stopover visit in Ireland, and sort of bring it back to the current subject and watch me do this. So he stopped over in Ireland and stayed at President Trump's resort at Doonbeg, which is, and I can verify this, three and a half hours driving away from the meetings that he had in Dublin. It's literally on the other side of the island. So, of course, when you can't afford a 3.5 hour drive, you fly. So he flew Air Force Two from one side of the island to another, costing taxpayers millions of dollars. Also, just tangentially, I think Mike Pence did sort of anger and upset his hosts by saying that Ireland, which is part of the European Union, had a quote-unquote responsibility to support Brexit, which it does not support. Irish Prime Minister Varadkar made that very clear. He does not support that, with the Irish Northern Ireland border being a major concern. I guess to bring it back to the previous subject, I grew up with Republicans that were all about cutting waste. They were all about saving money and small government. And you would think there would be an argument or a pathway to say, we're going to save enough money to pay for the wall. And yet you have Mike Pence spending millions of extra dollars in unnecessary travel, the president's golf travel, that sort of thing. Is there a pathway, really, for the Republicans to turn on a dime and say, we're going to save the money to pay for the wall rather than pull it from schools at military bases?
I would argue no. I mean, as long as Trump is president, I mean, this is an extraordinary situation when you think about it, because why did Pence stay at Trump's resort? He stayed because the president suggested that he stay there. Now, that is illegal. I mean, let's call a spade here. The Constitution says that the president gets a salary, and that's all he gets. That doesn't change. And he's not allowed to accept emoluments, which is gifts or more money.
$10 word for gifts.
Right. Yes. For either domestically or from foreign government. And by suggesting, this is something almost like you hear from mafia mobs. You know, it would be in your interests, Nahal, to make sure you stay at my hotel.
Nice family you got there. Hey. Maybe you should stay at the hotel with them.
Yes, exactly. And Pence, who is a Christian fundamentalist, but he does what the president asks. And the president, by the way, has denied suggesting that Pence stay at the hotel. Pence's own chief of staff is the one who says, yes, Trump suggested that he stay there. Now, who do you believe? The chief of staff, or are you going to believe your lying eyes?
I've heard that one before somewhere. I've heard that one before somewhere. I'll give you the close thought on
that. To the political question, you know, I think one thing that Republicans seem to be increasingly coming to the conclusion of is that their base does not really necessarily care about the financial stuff. That their base seems to be more driven by cultural types of things, by, you know, issues like abortion or immigration and these other things that have nothing to do with whether the deficit is exploding under Trump or not. And I think for more moderate, traditional establishment Republicans, maybe that matters more, but the base seems to have taken over. So for them, electorally speaking, I think they're just realizing that's the financial stuff, it's not going to drive much.
I think you're exactly right. It's a very astute analysis of that. The Trump base is a series of, or coalition of one vote voters who, or maybe one or two votes who combine together and really don't care about anything else besides those one or two things. Let's move on very quickly to Hurricane Dorian. Bahamas Prime Minister Hubert Minnis is pledging to do whatever is necessary to carry out rescue and recovery efforts. The hurricane devastated the Caribbean archipelago. It's focused around the island of Abaco, someplace I'm, again, very, very familiar with. Lots of aid rushing there. The metrics on this storm seem to be one of the worst that we've ever seen. 180 mile an hour sustained winds, things like this. I'll give you, Nahal, do you have any idea of what we're looking at in terms of damage now, in terms of casualties or anything like that?
Well, there's 30 confirmed dead, but there's a tremendous belief and fear that it's going to be much higher than that, the death toll. I mean, at least hundreds, possibly over 1,000, and many thousands are missing right now. So they're just trying to right now do a cleanup effort, essentially. And, you know, God knows what they're going to find. And it's going to be horrific no matter what. And, you know, with climate change, this could stand to become the new normal. And so you have to ask yourself the question of, like, are we going to just rebuild the same way we did before if we're going to have another storm like this next year? I don't know. I think there needs to be a grander strategy. And I don't see anyone really stepping up to deal with that.
Jonathan, I'll go with you. Your thoughts?
Well, it was a horrific catastrophe down there. And if you see the pictures of Abaco Island, just about looks like every other building was destroyed, totally destroyed. Trump has sent the Coast Guard in. There's big contrast, at least in his reaction to the disaster that just hit the Bahamas and the one that hit Puerto Rico. He very much made every effort to not give Puerto Rico the aid that it needed, but he's ready to give aid to the Bahamas.
We applaud that. We hope that we see as much aid as possible. And I'll throw this last question out there really quick, sort of a 30-second answer for each one of you. Obviously, this turns to an issue of climate change. We have to look at this when we see these ever-intensifying storms that are passing through and doing so much damage. Is there any way for the climate change issue to be turned into a national security issue? Could it be looked at in that way?
The Obama administration did look at climate change as a national security issue. And when you talk to, like, people from that administration, they'll tell you, yeah, they're worried about things like terrorism, et cetera, but climate is what keeps them up at night. I mean, there is a way, but when you have one political party that is completely unwilling to accept the idea that climate change is even a thing, then it's hard to tell how you're going to actually make that a reality. And it just may come down to local governments and state governments to really pick up the slack.
Jonathan, I'll give you the last word.
What's interesting about this climate change question is that, as a security issue, is that even though the administration ignores it as an issue, if you look at various Pentagon studies of national security strategy documents, every one of them mentions climate change as a national security issue.
Again, you have to have people who believe, as you say, it's a thing in order to address it. But it's certainly real enough to the people in Abaco. And we send, obviously, you know, all of our best wishes for everyone there and a speedy recovery to that area. That is all the time we have. Thanks to Nahal Tuzi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA.